Imagine, you're facing execution, but then in another trial, the prosecutor comes out and says, hey, actually it wasn't this guy, it was his co-defendant who was the real shooter. That's what happened to Jesse Duane Jacobs, and that's what we're diving deep into today, the Supreme Court case of Jacobs v. Scott.
It's definitely a complicated case, filled with legal arguments and some serious ethical questions. This case really throws a wrench in our understanding of due process, not to mention the serious implications for the death penalty.
We've got court documents, legal analyses, even Justice Stevens' dissenting opinion, all laid out before us. So are you ready to unpack this complex case and see where the need for finality bumps up against the pursuit of justice?
Absolutely. Let's untangle those legal knots one by one.
So starting with the basics, Jacobs and his sister, Bobby Hogan, were involved in this 1986 kidnapping and murder of Etta Urdiales. Jacobs confessed, but later said he was pressured into it and claimed it was Hogan who actually pulled the trigger, a fact he says he didn't know beforehand. But Texas law being what it is, he was still convicted and sentenced to death.
Yeah, Texas has this thing called the felony murder rule. It basically means that even if you didn't directly kill someone, if a death was a foreseeable outcome of a felony you committed, in this case kidnapping, you can still be found guilty of murder.
Okay, so even if Jacobs didn't pull the trigger, the court said the death was a foreseeable outcome of the kidnapping. That's crazy.
It is, and it gets even crazier. During Hogan's trial, which was separate, the prosecutor argued that she was the only shooter and that Jacobs had no idea the killing was going to happen.
Hold on a sec. This is the same prosecutor who used Jacobs' confession to get a conviction in his trial, right? Now they're saying something totally different. What gives?
That's the head-scratcher, isn't it? It makes you question the whole idea of foreseeability. If the prosecutor is later saying that Jacobs didn't know about the shooting, how could it have been considered a foreseeable outcome in the first place?
It does seem like a massive contradiction. Did the courts even address that?
They did. But they still decided to uphold Jacobs' conviction, saying that the killing could be considered a foreseeable consequence of the kidnapping, no matter what the prosecutor said later.
So even though the prosecutor basically changed their story, the court said that didn't change the original outcome. What did Jacobs do after that?
Well, he wasn't about to give up. He went through a whole maze of appeals, trying every avenue he could. He challenged his conviction in the Texas courts, filed a federal habeas corpus petition, which is basically a legal way of saying, hey, I'm being held unjustly, and eventually tried to get his case heard by the highest court in the land, the U.S. Supreme Court.
So how do you even get your case in front of the Supreme Court? Do you just send them a really strongly worded letter or something?
It's a bit more complicated than that. Usually you need what's called a certificate of probable cause, which basically signals to the Supreme Court that your appeal has some serious legal merit. It's like a golden ticket to get your case a hearing.
Did Jacobs manage to get that golden ticket?
Unfortunately not. Both the district court and the Fifth Circuit Court denied him that certificate, which made appealing to the Supreme Court much harder. It's like they were saying, we've looked at your case and we don't see enough here to bring it to the Supreme Court.
But this was a death penalty case, and there's this glaring inconsistency from the prosecutor. Did the Supreme Court step in at all?
They did consider his case, but ultimately denied certiorari, meaning they chose not to hear the appeal.
So that was it. End of the line.
Pretty much. And Justice Stevens, in his dissent, argued that it was fundamentally unfair to execute someone when the state itself is basically saying, oops, maybe we got it wrong. He was pretty sharp in his criticism.
Wow. Okay, so we've got a man facing execution despite the fact that the prosecutor basically contradicted their own case. And despite all of this, the courts upheld the conviction.
Exactly. And that's what makes Jacobs v. Scott such a controversial and frankly unsettling case. It forces us to ask, where's the line between the need for finality in our legal system and the pursuit of justice, especially when new evidence comes to light?
Let's break down those legal arguments a bit further. I'm still stuck on this whole foreseeability thing. How did the courts justify upholding the conviction even after the prosecutor's dramatic change of heart?
Well, there were four main legal issues that Jacobs' appeals brought up. First, there's the whole concept of actual innocence, which is about whether Jacobs, even though he wasn't the shooter, could still be considered guilty because the death was deemed a foreseeable outcome of the kidnapping.
But how can something be foreseeable when the prosecutor themselves later says that Jacobs had no clue the shooting was going to happen?
That's the tricky part, isn't it? This case really shines a light on how slippery the concept of foreseeability can be, especially when you have a prosecutor flip-flopping like this.
Okay, so one legal issue down, three more to go. What else was at play here?
Well, there's the Sawyer v. Whitley standard, which sets a really, really high bar for proving what's called actual innocence of the death penalty. It's not enough to just raise some doubts about the original conviction.
Wait, what? Actual innocence of the death penalty? Are there different kinds of innocence?
In a way, yes. Under Sawyer, to get off death row, you have to prove not only that you're innocent of the crime, but also that some kind of constitutional error happened during your trial that specifically led to the death sentence.
That's like proving your innocence twice. That's a tough ask.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult. And this case really shows just how hard it is to meet that standard.
Okay, two down, two to go. What else came up in Jacobs' appeals?
There's the issue of prosecutorial inconsistency. Could the state presenting these totally different positions in the two trials be seen as a violation of Jacobs' constitutional rights?
It seems pretty obvious that it should be. It's one story to get the conviction, then a totally different story later on. Something doesn't smell right there.
Ethically, it's definitely questionable. But legally, it's a bit less clear-cut. Courts have said that just having inconsistent prosecutorial theories by themselves don't automatically mean a conviction is invalid. There needs to be evidence of bad faith or deliberate misconduct on the part of the prosecutor.
So it's not just about the fact that the stories are different, it's about the intent behind it.
Exactly. And lastly, there's the question of mitigating evidence. Did the jury, when deciding Jacobs' sentence, get enough information about his claim that he didn't know the shooting was going to happen? Remember, this was a death penalty case, so that claim could have made a huge difference.
Yeah, I can see that. So how did the courts handle that one?
They basically upheld the way the jury instructions were given during sentencing, saying that it didn't violate any established legal precedents.
So we've got these four complex legal issues, all adding another layer of complexity to this already complicated case. I'm betting the Supreme Court justices weren't all on the same page about how to deal with this.
You are absolutely right about that. It was a real clash of legal titans in the Supreme Court on this one.
All right, let's hear about that clash. How did the Supreme Court justices grapple with these different arguments? Did they find any common ground, or was it a total showdown?
Well, picture this. Justice Scalia, a real stickler for the rules, was leading the charge for the majority. He was all about legal finality, like the system made a decision, let's move on.
So basically, case closed, even if things are a little messy.
Yeah, pretty much. Scalia acknowledges that maybe perfect justice isn't always possible, but he thinks it's super important to stick with the original decision. He's saying we can't just keep reopening every case every time something new pops up.
Okay, I get that. But doesn't that open the door for injustice, especially when you have a prosecutor changing their story like this?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? And that's where Justice Stevens comes in, ready to throw down a dissenting opinion that really shakes things up.
Okay, I'm all ears. What did Stevens have to say about this whole thing?
Justice Stevens was known for being a bit more, I don't know, compassionate, maybe. Anyway, he really went after the majority's decision, saying it was basically wrong to execute someone when the state itself is backtracking on their own case.
So it's like, hold up, we can't just prioritize wrapping things up over basic fairness, especially when we're talking about someone's life.
Exactly. And his dissent gets to the heart of the moral and ethical mess at the core of Jacobs v. Scott. It's not just legal mumbo-jumbo, it's about right and wrong.
This is a classic legal showdown. You've got sticking to the rules on one side and pursuing justice, even if it makes things complicated, on the other side.
It is. And it forces all of us, not just lawyers, to think about some tough questions. When does sticking to a decision become a roadblock to justice? How do we balance consistency with the truth?
Especially when someone's life is on the line. It's a huge responsibility.
Absolutely. And it highlights the huge responsibility prosecutors have. Their decisions can have massive ripple effects.
Speaking of prosecutors, this whole inconsistency thing is really bothering me. It feels wrong when the person representing the state can just switch their story like that.
You're right. Jacobs v. Scott shines a light on what can happen when prosecutors aren't consistent. It makes you question the whole legal process.
Makes you wonder, should there be some way to hold prosecutors accountable when their stories don't add up?
It's a good question. We have some things in place, like appealing decisions or filing complaints. But some people say that's not enough.
What else can we do? Are there any ways to prevent these situations or at least reduce the harm they cause?
It's complicated. Some experts suggest stricter rules for prosecutors, requiring them to be more transparent about their decisions. Others say we need more oversight, maybe through independent panels.
Sounds like there's no easy answer. We need some big changes to how things are done.
Exactly. It's about making sure justice is the goal, not just getting convictions.
This conversation has really gotten me thinking. It's different seeing these legal ideas play out in real life with such huge consequences.
I agree. Cases like this take those legal theories out of the textbooks and show us what they really mean.
And this case really shows us how important it is to get things right, especially when we're talking about the death penalty.
No room for error there. The risk of injustice is just too high.
And that takes us back to the core questions raised by Jacobs v. Scott. When does wanting things to be final prevent us from achieving justice? And when people are involved, some mistakes will happen. How do we ensure the death penalty is only used when it's absolutely deserved? These aren't just questions for lawyers. They're questions for everyone.
Absolutely. This case challenges us to think about balancing the rules with protecting individual rights.
This has been a lot to think about. If you're interested, I'd encourage you to learn more about this case and others like it.
I agree. Do some research on Jacobs. Look into other cases where inconsistencies affected the outcome.
Learning is a journey, and cases like this are important stops along the way. They make us question what we think, push us to think critically, and remind us that the pursuit of justice is never really over.
Well said. And with that, why don't we shift gears and look at what this case means for legal professionals?
Let's do that. I'm especially curious about that felony murder rule, especially in Texas where it's still in effect.
The felony murder rule is fascinating and definitely controversial. It has a long history and still causes a lot of debate.
Let's unpack it a little. How does it work in real life? And what are some things lawyers need to think about when dealing with it?
Well, imagine this. Imagine you're involved in a felony, let's say a robbery, and something goes wrong, someone ends up dead. Even if you didn't pull the trigger, you never intended for anyone to get hurt, you could still be slapped with a murder charge under the felony murder rule.
So basically, bad things happen during a crime you're involved in. You're on the hook, even if you didn't directly cause the death.
That's the gist of it. It's based on this idea that if you're participating in a dangerous felony, you're responsible for any deaths that result, whether you intended them or not.
It seems pretty harsh. Like, what if you genuinely had no idea things were going to escalate like that?
That's the tricky part, and that's what makes the felony murder rule so controversial. It doesn't always take into account individual culpability or the specific circumstances of the crime.
So for lawyers working on cases like this, especially in Texas, what are the key things they need to keep in mind?
Well, Jacobs serves as a stark reminder that this rule can really come back to bite you. It highlights the importance of carefully evaluating the potential risks and liabilities for clients involved in any felony, even if they believe their role is minimal.
So basically, lawyers need to be extra careful when advising clients in these situations, making sure they understand the potential consequences of their actions.
Absolutely. And it underscores the need for strong legal representation. A skilled attorney can make a huge difference in these cases, arguing for a lesser charge, presenting mitigating evidence, and generally fighting for the best possible outcome for their client.
It's a good reminder that we all need a good lawyer in our corner, just in case things go south.
You got that right. So, Jacobs v. Scott, it's not just an interesting legal puzzle, it's a wake-up call. It shines a light on the flaws and inconsistencies that can pop up in the legal system. It challenges us to think about how we balance the need for finality with the pursuit of justice. And it forces us to grapple with some seriously tough ethical questions about prosecutorial conduct and the use of the death penalty.
It definitely makes you think. When does the desire to wrap things up neatly prevent us from getting to the truth? And when we know human error is a factor, how can we be 100% certain the death penalty is only used when it's truly deserved?
Those questions are bigger than just the law. They make us look at our own beliefs about fairness, about taking responsibility, and about what justice really means.
Well, I think we've given our listeners a lot to chew on today. Hopefully, they'll walk away with a deeper understanding of Jacobs v. Scott and its implications, and maybe even be inspired to learn more about the legal system and how it works.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Until next time, folks, keep those minds curious. And remember, sometimes the deepest dives lead to the most unexpected discoveries.